You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 109. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about Kalash heritage and the legacy of archaeology in Pakistan. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute peoples, treaty lands, the Dineta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Dr. Uzma Rizvi and Syed Gul Kalash on the show. Dr. Uzma Rizvi is a professor of anthropology and urban studies at Pratt Institute. With nearly two decades of work on decolonizing methodologies, intersectional feminist strategies, and transdisciplinary approaches, her work has intentionally pushed disciplinary limits and demanded ethical decolonial praxis at all levels of engagement, from teaching to research. Rizvi is the principal investigator for the Laboratory for Integrated Archaeological Visualization and Heritage, currently working with her team at the UNESCO World Heritage Site of Mohenjo-Daro, Pakistan. One of her first articles, published in 2006, Accounting for Multiple Desires, Decolonizing Methodologies, Archaeology, and the Public Interest, published in India Review, has been an important touchstone for folks working on decolonizing methodology in the Global South. And fresh off the press, released this month, Crafting as World Making by Berghahn Press. So welcome to the show, Uzma.
Thanks so much for having me, Jessica.
All right. And Syed Gul Kalash is an archaeologist, museum professional, and cultural preservationist from the Kalash Valley, Chitral, Pakistan. As the first and only woman from the Kalash community to pursue archaeology and anthropology professionally, she has led museums, served as a field archaeologist, and contributed to the preservation of cultural heritage. She also worked at the UNESCO World Heritage Buddhist Sites in Taxila, where she delivered lectures to monks, ambassadors, dignitaries, and international visitors on the history, archaeology, and Buddhist heritage of the region. Her work focuses on museum leadership, heritage conservation, public engagement, and safeguarding the endangered language, traditions, and cultural identity of the Kalash community. Welcome, Gul Kalash, to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Thank you, Jessica. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, I'm so excited to have both of you on the show and to learn more. I believe you guys are the first guests that we've had to speak to Pakistan specifically. I believe we had one episode in South Asia, but I believe you guys are the first Pakistan episode. So yeah, I'm so excited to have both of you on the show. This is a new topic for me. Very excited to learn about Kalash heritage, about the legacy of archaeology in Pakistan, and just learn more from both of you about your journeys. So to get us started, right off the bat with that, Uzma, would you mind giving our listeners a little bit of background about what got you interested in this work?
Sure. And thank you again, Jessica, for inviting us both to be on the show. Just to contextualize, I'm not speaking from Pakistan at the moment. I'm in the unceded lands of the Lenape, just to kind of name that as well. You know, I started archaeology many decades ago now. Like it's, you know, it feels like it's been quite a long journey. I started doing classical and Greek archaeology. That's actually my background in undergrad. Okay. Yeah. So I went to Bryn Mawr, and we have a very strong classical and Greek kind of tradition there. And I didn't really grow up, I think a lot of archaeologists kind of grow up, or many archaeologists grow up knowing they want to do archaeology. I actually wanted to do international relations and politics. Like I actually wanted to go into contemporary political work, which in retrospect makes a lot of sense given the direction my work has taken. But it ended up, I think it was my sophomore year or my junior year, my advisor sat down with me as an undergrad and was just like, I don't know if you've realized this, but you've taken a ton of archaeology classes. Is this something you're interested in majoring in? And I was just like, well, I hadn't thought about it, you know? And there is this one moment when I was in my intro to archaeology class. And, you know, we were learning about Mesopotamia and we're learning about pottery and this beveled rim bowl came by and, you know, it was just kind of passed around in our class. This is roughly, we're thinking about 4,000 BC, sometimes somewhere as early as 5,000. And it's just, you know, a really quickly made bowl. And as we were passing it around, it came into my hands and my fingerprints matched the fingerprints directly onto of the potter, who probably, you know, put it on the wheel, pulled it up fast while it was still a little wet and moved it over to dry. And that was really a moment of transformation for me. That moment, I suddenly, it collapsed time and space in a way that I had never experienced. And I think that's why I kept coming to those archaeology classes, because they allowed me to look at politics and international relations in the past. And I pulled that into the heritage work that I do, because I'm so, I know that there are politics embedded in the heritage work that we do, right? So I kind of, I can see the trajectory now that it's been over 25 years, 30 years that I've been doing this work. So yeah, that would be, that's kind of how I got into that segment, that archaeological kind of, the archaeological trajectory of my career.
There is something about fingerprints, like you can hear, you can see it a lot in the mortar when people build walls and things like that. And there's something about it that's just so human. And
in the archive too, like when you see people's thumbprints or ink prints, because they've been left, that it really is something about the print that's about identity, you know, that is the person, is the kind of physicality of the person in that material.
Yeah, it's so special. Yeah, that's special. Before I get too distracted by fingerprints. So Gulkalash, what about you? What got you interested in this type of work?
This is my favorite question, I think, since I grew up in the Kailash Valley and since I become an archaeologist. Nobody asked this question before to me, that why I am an archaeologist. So I think this is my first time. So I can tell that the real story behind being an archaeologist for me. When I was a kid, like I was studying in, maybe I remember I was in sixth class. So like I meet a lot of researchers, group of people that came to Kailash Valley to do their dental casting. Like the dental casting is an anthropology thing to do. They to, you know, to know about the cast of Kailash, because the Kailash tribe itself is like, it is the history is like the origin is always in the big debates that from where they came from. Like somebody described us that we are descendant of Alexander the Great. Somebody told that we are from the Aryan tribe, and the Kailash themselves, they said we are from the, you know, from somewhere of Siam and like that. So the people came there for the dental casting. Being an only child who speaks barely Urdu, so they hire me as a volunteer to help them to bring the people and translate them what they want to do during the dental casting. It was like in the, when I was in my sixth class. And since I belong to a very, very remote region, so Dr. Usma already know about that. So it, that place is, we don't have that much options to do, you know. Our opportunities are very limited. And we don't have a lot of options to do, to think about our future, to dream big like that. So I didn't know there is an archaeology, which is particularly a subject I'm going to do that. I didn't know about that. So in the sixth class, when I was doing that thing, and I was thinking what these people are doing, what does this mean to us? But for me, the exciting thing was they give us the free brush and toothpaste. So that was the interesting thing for me, that I'm getting the toothbrush and toothpaste from them. It's for free, you know, I'm not paying for it. And then after my 14 years of education, still I didn't know there is an archaeology, because always people choose the subject for me and I don't know what I'm going to do. Always somebody else decide for me what I'm going to do. So after my 14 years education, that I was watching a documentary, which is again the Mohenjo-Daro and the National Geographic. So I forced my father that took me to Mohenjo-Daro to see the ruins there, because I really want to go there to see that. But my father put a condition on me, if you get a good marks in your exams, then I will put you there. But still, my father didn't do that promise, didn't complete that promise. But I went to Mohenjo-Daro by myself as an archaeologist. And then I later on, I attended a conference in Pakistan, which was about archaeology and Gandhar archaeology and Indus Valley civilization. So the people were talking about the stones and the writings on the stage. And being a Kailashi girl, my English was so poor and I didn't understand what they are talking there. And so when the second day I stand up there and I ask them a question, that we are all Pakistanis are here. There is no foreigner here. Why you people are not talking in Urdu? I want to know what is this? What's going on here? And that thing really clicked to the professors there who were there, the archaeologists. That thing really clicked their mind. And the professor, Dr. Ehsan Ali, who is a very, you know, big name in Pakistan as an archaeologist, Dr. Mohammed Zahir, they were there. And they said, okay, Gul, why you not join the archaeology? Why you're not coming to Hazara University to study archaeology? And I said, oh, wow, what is archaeology? And they said, it is a subject where you can learn about all these things. And I said, okay. So I went to Hazara University, and I never feel like ashamed to tell this, that I spent almost 6 months, one semester, to correct the archaeology spelling because I came from the Urdu background. There was no such thing, like the English was so tough for me. So every morning I get up 2 a.m. in the morning and I try to study hard to be in the competition of the other students in the class. But I was really, lucky to have a lot of teachers around me. They supported me a lot and they encouraged me. And then Dr. Samat, he's my director now, and he said that, Gul Kailash, you came from the right place and you are at the right place. So from here, you can preserve your own culture. You can do things for your Kailash. So since Dr. Usman knows already about it, that there was a lot of bundles of books wrote on Kailash. There are a lot of documentaries made on Kailash. But there was always a gap which was filled by the people, that the gap was between the interpreters and the Kailash community. So my professors encouraged me to do, as a Kailashi, to do my own research on my people, to do my own things for my people, to preserve my culture, which is only 4,000 around the world now. So we are the most endangered community and endangered species in the world. So I should think about it and I should preserve my own culture to work for it. So that's how I become an archaeologist. And there is another thing which was like, I want to mention here. It was my first time when I was part of an excavation in Chitral. We were dealing with the bones. And when I came to know that bones were really our ancestors, like that was the Gandhara grave culture, which is called, like, it is the grave site called Gandhara grave culture. A lot of scholars call that. So when I was working there and I was dealing with the bones, and I really felt that emotions, the attachment with the bones, you know, you're doing things knowingly or unknowingly. But later on, I realized that it was not the right thing to do that with, you know, your own ancestors' bones. And then I become very famous in Chitral, that the people called me grave digger, like, you know. So like, it was like the grave digger is like, they didn't know that it is an archaeology. The people called me grave digger. And my grandfather was really upset about it. And he told me that people, when they get education, they did a great job and you are doing the grave digging thing. This is not really culturally allowed to you. So that's how I become, like, slowly, gradually. Then I met Dr. Usma after my master's, and I met Dr. Jonathan Kinnair, Mark Kinnair, and then my professor, of course, Dr. Abdul Samad. There are a lot of people that helped me to become an archaeologist. So there are a lot of stories. I think if I start to telling them, that maybe it will take a lot of time. Yeah.
So, okay, I want to ask you a question. Thinking about all of that, when you were growing up, did you know about, like, how people were presenting your community? Or was that something more that you discovered, like, when you were studying archaeology?
Yes, that is how the first time, like, I went to that conference in Pakistan to attend the conference. There was a professor, he was presenting Kailash. So he was talking about the Kailash community, but he was talking in English. I didn't understand much about that, what he's going to talk about it. But there was something which really clicked my mind, and I was thinking, this is not right. And that's why I was a little bit loud to him, and I stand up on my chairs and I said, you're talking about us, and why you're not talking in Urdu? So we understand that what you are talking about us. So that really clicked in my mind, that the people who are representing Kailash, in somehow there is misunderstanding between them and the community. There is a gap between them and the community, because they always, they choose someone to translate the questions they ask to the Kailash community. So the translator always translate whatever he wants to translate, because those were not Kailashis. So that's why I felt that this is the right time for me to do things right for my own community, at least I can contribute a little bit to make things like in their own way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there any particular things that people have said about your community that you want to make sure people know are not right, or like anything that you particularly want people to know about the Kalashi community?
Of course, like there are a lot of things I want to tell the people that they know about the community, because if you Google the Kalash, or if you go to the UN, misunderstanding and misinterpretation of Kalash, the people, because the Kalash is only 4,000 people in Pakistan, they are living in just a remote area, and they dress like I dress today so much. And I think a lot now the world is a kind of global village. So the people, I feel, the technology is the most powerful thing. So if I want to show my culture dress to the people, I would love to do that. So let's do that. Yes.
Okay, yeah. Great. So yeah. We'll put a picture in the show notes so everyone can see what Gokalash is referring to.
Thank you so much for that. So they roam around without like dupatta, or without, hide their face and like that stuff. And they greet people like smiling face and like that. So people have a lot of misunderstanding about them. And they think that the Kalasha community is like they always try to develop people. Like research paper I discussed already with my professor, Dr. Usma, she's here, she's witness. There is a research in Qaid-e-Azam University, a lady met on Kalash, and she misinterpreted a lot of things in her research paper. So, when you're doing things and you didn't, there is always the gap, as I mentioned. If you're not talking to the people who own the culture, if you're not knowingly, you're not talking to them and you're not getting to understand the culture, there is a lot of do's and don'ts in Kalash community. So they don't care about that. So they publish just to get their own PR thing, So they publish things and they talk on the TV or the YouTube channel just to create viewers, or just to create like that kind of stuff. So when I was reading her PhD thesis, she's from Islamabad. She did her research and she mentioned a lot of Kalash people on her research book already. So there were a lot of things she misinterpreted the things about Kalash. And like the way she represented the Kalash, that's not the appropriate way to doing this. So she's not the only one. There were a lot of research paper I read and I witnessed that the people interpret the things in the wrong way. So that is the reason, the people, they don't understand the culture, and they just see some like 2 minutes or some TikTok about the Kalash or something like on they see on the social media, and they come during the festival year with a lot of, a lot of expectations. They can get a woman there, they can get married with them. But unfortunately, that is not the case in Kalash. The Kalash people, they really, they really love their culture. They really love their valley. It is not like somebody come there for the festival and they can get married anybody. That is not the real thing, So that is how the people, they misinterpret the Kalash. And just a few days ago, I had an opportunity to go through with the social media post. There was a lot of my community boys, they were complaining about that the KVDA presentation. KVDA is a Kalasha Development Authority, nowadays working to preserve the Kalash in the valleys. So the KVDA person, they were giving a presentation, but they misinterpret the Kalash religion especially. And so there, everybody was, they were angry on them that this is a huge organization who is working to preserve the Kalash, but they are still doing such a big mistake in a huge platform. So they should consider it. They should hire some people who are really know the Kalash culture, who really want to do something very on the reality base for the community. So that's how our communities now, they are getting education. They know how to protect their culture. They know how to talk. They know how to, tell the people that they are wrong. So that's a good thing now coming up from the community. So I hope for the best that in future will be different, that they will preserve their own culture in a real way. So I hope for that. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like they need more of you. And on that note, we are already at our first break point, so we will be right back here in a second. All right. So we are back from our break, and I can't wait to hear about how the two of you started working together. Especially, it's so funny that you were watching that documentary about the site that Uzma worked at. So it just seemed almost like fate. So I'm excited to hear the actual story of how the two of you started working together.
Okay. So like for me, we don't, as Uzma ma'am said, that there are not a lot of people, especially the female, they are in archaeology. So there are few female, they were really actively on the field. Of course, if there are archaeologists, they work in the museums and the universities, they not go actually to the field, like to do the digging thing, to do the real archaeology work. So when I first met Dr. Uzma, it was 2012, and I still remember that day. And she came and she talked about her work, and I was sitting in the with the audience, and I was getting inspired and kind of her talk. And then there was a lady, she's a great archaeologist from Pakistan. Her name is Dr. Uzma.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Uzma Ibrahim.
From Karachi. Yes. So like she was talking about her, and she said, I'm going to take her to the dinner. And I was so jealous, and I was thinking, oh my God, I'm not that much huge archaeologist. Maybe one day I had the opportunity to take her for dinner. Maybe I had the opportunity to talk to her, because for me, she was a celebrity in that time. And I was thinking about that. And I still remember that when Uzma Ibrahim told me that she's taking her for dinner, and I was so much jealous. And I didn't tell her that I want to join. Because I want to tell her that I want to join, but I didn't, because I was thinking, oh my God, if I tell this to her, maybe she mind it or something, like, you know, but she's so sweet. Later on, I know her. She was so sweet, and I didn't tell her that I want to join. And she was telling her that about how our daughter is 3 months old, and she was communicating at home to taking care of her own phone. And then she's fully concentration, keeping the concentration on the conference as well. So for me, it was like, you know, a female archaeologist who is doing the both work together. Like she's taking care of her 3 months old daughter, and she's also doing the archaeology, and she's engaging with everyone. And the best part was I was dancing with the music on the floor, and I was not expecting anybody can join me for the dance. Because in Pakistan, ladies dancing on the floor is something like very unique opportunity, you know. So she came and she started dance with me, and then everybody joins us. There were a lot of female, they join us for the dance. So that was again an inspiring thing for me. And after that conference, then she gave me her email address to communicate with her. And after that, it was like a huge gap, like 3 years gap in 2015, that we got an opportunity for a workshop in Pakistan. Yeah, yeah. She was leading the workshop, and she was there with us, and she was talking one by one everybody's that their needs and their publications about, and their what they want to do in archaeology. So when I came to her and I start crying, and I was like, you know, I was not thinking about anything. I just want to talk to her. I just want to talk, and I don't know what. But I was talking about the random things, and because like I was thinking, oh my God, she's such a huge archaeologist. I can't talk about archaeology with her because she knows everything. So I was thinking about, and I was talking about random things, not the actual thing. And she said, Gulkalash, slow down. Tell me what you want to do. And I was looking at her, and my tears were like coming in my eyes, and I didn't know what I'm going to do, because it was, for me, it was like a fan meeting, you know, like you're mm-hmm. meeting someone, you're admiring a lot, and then you're meeting with someone, and that then your mind is blank. You didn't think about anything. And then she said, you know, my daughter is now, she is 3 years old. And then I want you to, you are still like, you know, it was, yes, 3 years old. And she said that this has been 3 years and you didn't did anything like upgrade yourself. You're still masters. My daughter is 3 years old now. So why you're not doing anything? And I was like, oh my God, this is something like I should do about it. Then, of course, there were a lot of things coming in my life, and I was supporting a home and like I doing job, and I didn't continue my education. In 2020, and I emailed her again. And I said, ma'am, I'm going to the university for my post-graduation. And she was more than excited anyone in the world. And she said, oh my God, Gulkalash, you gave me such a brilliant news. So what is the problem? Please you can do that. And I said, no, like it is this, blah, blah. Actually, I had a financial problem that time. And she understands that. And she said, okay, don't worry about that. Just go to the university, complete your post-graduation. That's how I went to the university. Then we worked together about my research. Like she was my mentor. She was my supervisor. And I really thankful to the Qaid-e Azam University, the head of department, Dr. Ghani. She allowed me to do that. He allowed me to do with her, because usually in Pakistan, when you're doing post-graduation, they always prefer to somebody from the department you can work with. But they allow me on the special case to work with her. And I think I'm very lucky. And I think the universe chose me to be in this way. And sometime I describe, if I was not archaeologist, maybe I was nothing. Maybe like nobody knows me. Maybe I was somewhere in the valleys doing nothing. And then I meet this incredible people in my life and they boost up me to do whatever I am doing. So I think that's how we start working.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe I'll jump in here and tell my side of the story then, because I think you're far too modest. And sometimes when we have our own journeys, we don't see what other people see. And I think it's actually what all of us have seen. Some of us have seen it. You know, Mark has seen it. I've seen it. You are a remarkable person, thinker, scholar, researcher. And it's been an honor to support your journey the whole way. So let's just go back to this 2012 moment, because I think it's so funny that there are particular things that you have in your memory, because I remember those moments too, but in a very different way. I remember it was like after the dinner, we all came to that large room where the music was playing and there were maybe one or two guys dancing and then you were dancing. And I remember, I think I had overheard you say to someone that there are all these misconceptions about Galasha women because we dance, because we're out and because we do all these things. And in Pakistan, as Gul was saying, you know, it's a very conservative traditional culture where women, it's a class-based issue, it's caste, it's religion. You know, women don't dance in public. It's not considered to be something that's done, right? And so, and I think that kind of contextualizes also what Gul was saying in terms of the ways in which, especially domestic tourism that happens in the Kalasha Valley, they're coming there because it's a very different gendered scenario where the women are actually in, like there, it's less of a patriarchal system where, and in that system there's, and correct me if I'm wrong, Gul, but the women have the option to choose how they want to be. And there's just, it's a different society. And so it becomes very difficult when it comes to issues of harassment, right? And I think that was partially what I'd heard just snippets of the conversation that she was having with another junior colleague of hers. And they were talking about harassment. And Gul is, as you know from the story before, will stand up on tables and tell people what the problem is. She'll be like, you need to speak in Urdu. This is not okay. And so she was just like, you shouldn't take this from that person. You need to do this. And you, and I was like, I don't know what's happening here, but I love it. I was like, I love all of this fun. I love everything about this. And this is, and so when she was dancing, there were people who were just like, oh, we don't do that. And I was like, yeah, we do. And so I was like, this, we're going to dance. And so, you know, for those who, you know, this is a podcast, again, you can't see me. I wear hijab. I wear a dupatta on my head, you know, and it's important to me. It's part of my identity. It's part of who I am. But in that moment, it was really important for me to be there on the floor with her. And I didn't have to move a lot. I just had to be there on the floor with her to allow people to see that it, this was something that everyone was doing otherwise. These women are dancing everywhere else. It's just in these particular cases, they don't feel like they can. And so I think there's a way in which one shows allyship and one shows, you know, what it means to be an accomplice or to be standing as a wall to protect someone, you know?
Yeah.
That's not just about, you know, Gul as an indigenous woman. That's as, you know, women being sisters like that. This is about women. This is not, you know? And so I think that moment for me was really important. And as we were dancing, we were talking about stuff. And then afterwards we had a conversation and I was just like, we really need to support this young woman. I think Gul as a scholar is very focused and clear about why she's doing what she's doing. Her ethics are clear. Her values are clear and her methodology is clear. Right. Mm-hmm. And then this insistence on ensuring that folks check with the communities, folks who are doing research, who are going to publish on this, actually speak to Kalash people is hugely important. It's hugely important everywhere in the world. Right. Mm-hmm. And for her to be a lone voice, then to have to do that, like this has got to be protected and supported and brought to bear. You know, I know 2015 when we did the session, this was something that Mark had organized as a capacity building. And he invited me to be one of the guest speakers there. And, you know, Gul was one of the attendees, and it was on decolonizing archaeology. And I was just like, how are we going to change how we teach archaeology in Pakistan, right? And this is 2015. We had a lot of junior faculty predominantly, and we had a lot of museum professionals, right? And one of the things that Gul mentioned is that we have very few women who do Pakistani archaeologists who are in Pakistan. And so we really focused in, even though they were like really junior at the time, or they were just doing their master's and working in museums, we thought it was really important for them to be there as well. What's really lovely is that community of individuals, we all became a network. And it's from that network, you know, obviously we all grow up and then we all become heads of departments and we all become chairs. And so when we, you know, when she's talking about working at Qaid-e Azam, the head of the department was Dr. Ghani, who was also at that workshop, someone who I've also worked with over the many years. I do lots of other work in that department as well, you know, being committed to doing archaeology in Pakistan. So that department really wanted to support Gul's work. And, you know, there are ways in which systems can support important work, right? It's, you know, and it's hard, but, you know, yeah. So,
I mean, there's so many things I want to say, but yeah, no, I was just agreeing with you mostly. And I mean, I think what I'd really be interested in hearing about next from both of you is to have each of you describe the work that you are currently doing.
So I think we mentioned earlier that I'm running a lab called the Laboratory for Integrated Archaeological Visualization and Heritage. We call it LIAV. And this is an interdisciplinary lab. We're making connections between technology, archaeological data management, and heritage data management, as well as heritage practice and data visualization. So a lot of the stuff that we do intersects and brings data, especially legacy data. We're really committed from an ethical perspective to do legacy-based work. Because, you know, in an explicitly feminist, queer, anti-colonial, anti-racist platform, we actually, I'm not sure if I believe anymore that excavations are the way to go. Yeah. Because there's so much data out there. And I just find it to be, I was talking earlier today to a student about how I love excavating. I love it. There's something transformative that happens. And so I get it. I know why we love excavations. But it is non-consensual. Mm-hmm. It is extractive and non-consensual for my pleasure only. And so just every word in that sentence drips of colonial misogyny. And I just can't do it anymore. And so I, like, all the work that I do is non-invasive now. It's based on legacy data. We're thinking a lot about data visualization. We're thinking a lot about how visualizations aren't just about reconstructions, but can be used for analysis. And so a lot of original data analysis is happening. We're kind of recoding. We're treating colonial data as data error, and we're scraping the data again and kind of thinking through how to code the same excavations that happened 100 years ago differently by reconstructing through the original reports and archives what the excavations were and then mapping it on what we see at the site. So that's why I'm at Mohenjo-Daro itself. Mohenjo-Daro is a third millennium BCE archaeological site. So we're talking about 2600 BCE. It's quite early as well. We have Côte d'Aiguillon layers, which is just, it's pre-urban. We get urbanism integration, and then kind of a post-urban era. So we're really looking at the cities. This is an incredibly well-planned city. So we have lots of architectural models. We've got, it's on cardinal directions. So north, south, east, west, everything is beautifully organized. It's got wells. It's got, like, at least for every four houses, a well, if not in the more affluent neighborhoods, wells in every house, sometimes on the second floor. You know, so there's a lot going on at this ancient site. Like, I could talk extensively about its infrastructure and waste management system, which is one of my, like, loves for the site, but I'm not going to. But when we think about monumentality, like, it doesn't have to have the pyramids. It has monumentality when it comes to civic infrastructure. So I've been doing a lot of work there, looking at archives, doing kind of photogrammetry, doing a lot of LIDAR work, thinking about how to bring legacy data and connect it in, making things more interactive, thinking about how to do community-based work and public work in a way that brings the data back to the people. So I was invited to work at Mohenjo-Daro in 2018 by some senior female scholars who said, our students don't have access to any of the data from Mohenjo-Daro, which is mind-blowing to me because the major site in Pakistan was just not accessible. was just not accessible. Like, you'd expect so many masters and PhDs to come out of the site, but all of them are coming out from external international areas, which basically means there's a data blockage in within the country. So everything that we're doing is really about making data, that data, accessible to all. And, you know, there are always questions around data sovereignty and open data issues, which I think are very important. In this particular case, because it's already a UNESCO World Heritage Site, the data is public, right? And so we're just very careful about the ways in which we use the data so that it unintentionally may not harm. But we do we do need our students in Pakistan to have that data, right? We need them to be able to access the, you know, an important site in Pakistan. So anyhow, that's a long story, kind of a some of the work that I'm doing now at Mohenjo-Daro.
Yeah, I have a follow-up, first of all. And then, so I think we're going to have Ghul start with her work in the next segment. But so what you're talking about, the community related to the site, what, which community are we talking about? Like, are you talking, is this descendants? Is this like the community that lives right there? Is this like, how are they related when you say like engaging the community?
Yeah, that's a great question because it's very different. So in past work I've done, I've worked with folks who live in and around the site, right? And you have school groups, you have community groups, you have stake, what we call traditionally stakeholders who are invested in, you know, history and heritage. At Mohenjo-Daro, it's really interesting. So the groups that I'm working with, a lot of first generation students who are coming from the local universities, who are living in and around the site, right? So their villages are close by to the site, but they're not on the site because the site has been a World Heritage Site since the 80s, right? It's 83. And it's been excavated since the 1920s, 1921, 22. The larger excavations happened in 27 to 31, you know, so it's been excavated quite a bit. So it's been a site in local memory. When I think about the communities I'm working with now are really those individuals who have been living on or very close to the site, right? So in the last 100 years, because I haven't met folks who claim ancestry to Mohenjo-Daro.
Okay.
So we're not talking about descendant communities in that way. There are many communities of individuals who claim a heritage to it. And that's a different, like that there are different kind of conversations that we can have around that. And, but in terms of the folks who I'm working with on site, we're doing a lot of interviews and what we call in our IRB, it's called chai biscuit, which basically means tea and cookies. But in, you know, when we do chai biscuit, it really is a different kind of methodology. It's really about shifting the power dynamic of an interview to becoming something that we have outdoors. We sit and we have tea together. And so a lot of these folks who are near retirement, who have retired, have been like the foreman for conservation or the jockeydars, the guardsmen. And when they usually come to an officer's office, they stand at the door and they don't sit and have tea because they're, you know, there are all these hierarchies. So one of the ideas was to really kind of break those hierarchies by having it outdoors, by having it, you know, in a circle, having tea and biscuits where I'm the one who's serving the tea. And I'm the one who's bringing the biscuits, so that there's a different power hierarchy. In those conversations, one of the things that I've come to recognize is that there's a way in which they speak of the site that makes them of the site and the site of them. I talk a lot about care in relationship to the work that I do at Mohenjo-Daro. And this really comes from those community meetings and those conversations. They talk about how the site cares for them and they care for the site. So their relationship is not one just strictly of labor, but it's of history and love. One of the gentlemen I spoke to just this last year was just like, well, and he was near retirement. Like they were having his retirement party later on that week. And he was just like, well, I was born right here. And I was like, what? You were born on this site? And he was just like, yeah, like we, you know, because there was a flood in the, I think in the 40s and 50s that kind of it really like a lot of the villages were underwater and it was really problematic. And so what happened is that a lot of them came and lived on the site because the site is actually in a Pleistocene ridge. So it's higher. Okay. Even in the flood in the 2022 and 23, there were massive floods. The whole area around Mohenjo-Daro was completely flooded. When you look at the maps, the satellite maps, there's one area in that whole sea of blue that's still standing, and that's Mohenjo-Daro, the ancient site. Wow. So it's kind of fascinating. So these folks were, you know, they were born on the site. They ran around the site when they were kids. They had all these stories about where they would play, what they'd do, a lot of the kids who are now like in their 20s and 30s, they like remember being at the museum, growing up in the museum, learning how to draw in the museum. You know, so this is a community who may not claim direct descendants, but are very much like literally on the site, like in the site, are part of the site, you know, are living there, are eating there, are their daily everything is that site. So that's what I mean when I talk about communities and community-based work.
Yeah, I love that. Also, now I really want to have some giant cookies. I'm like, can that be a new theme for the podcast? Like, we each just, anyway.
Yeah, come over. Come out to Brooklyn and I'll see you in cookies. Yeah, I'd love it. Or come to Mohenjo-Daro, even better.
Oh, wow.
That is the chai you experience in the hot weather in Mohenjo-Daro. That's something else that really hit you in a different way.
Yeah. Okay. You got a date.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, we are going to have to come back and hear about Gokulash's master's thesis and her work right after we come back from this break. We'll be right back. Okay, so our third and final segment. I don't know how we're going to get through it all, but Gokulash, whatever you want to talk about work-wise, your master's thesis, your current work, you know, something you're especially proud of. Just tell us about your work.
Okay, so my master's thesis was all about a very special ritual, which we, since from the centuries, we are doing during the winter festival. And that was really clicking my mind because I was reading an article about Kailash, and there was a scholar from Germany. She mentioned that the rock carving in Kailash, the people believe they are for the fertility of animals, although this is just like they believe on it. But he tried to deny the Kailash belief system. So I was discussing that with Dr. My mentor, she's here. I told her that this scholar is saying this about the tradition, the ritual. And she said, girl, nobody allows to question somebody else's belief system. So you are from the community and you're going to do this. And then I told her that this is the only few lines I found about my literature review for my master thesis. There is no other data. And she said, that's why you're going to do this. And so, like, I collect all the data and then I make the questionnaires and I send the questionnaires to her. And she said, no, girl, this is a very particular questions you're going to ask to your own community. Mm. You are a scholar. You can't set them that why you're doing this. The why is always a dangerous thing you're asking somebody. So it makes scare the people when you're saying that why you're believing. No. Don't say that. Sit with them, discuss with them from since when they are doing this ritual. What is the, like, you know, so what is the benefits of this ritual they are doing and what they learn from it? What are, like, the concept, like that kind of things, you know? And she said, don't ask the direct question. Mm-hmm. And just sit with them and discuss with them. They will tell their part of their story automatically to you. So just don't be like an outsider going there with a particular questionnaire and you're asking them and you're writing things. And that really touched my heart. And when I went to the valleys, believe me, ma'am, I hate tea. But during that research, per day, I drink almost 20 to 15 cups of tea. Because everybody offers me tea. If I don't drink it, they feel like that I am there just for my own thing, you know? So
yeah,
I try to be an obedient student, as my teacher described that, to be part of them. So being a part of them, I drink a lot of tea during my research. So sometimes they offer me wine, like the grape wine. And when I take the wine, I sleep. I didn't do anything. And after that, when I collect all those data, and sometimes like in the very beginning, when I start the research, nobody wants to talk to me. When I ask them, they said, you know more than us. And you can write whatever you want. So that was really difficult for me. Then when ma'am told me that be part of them, be the part of the discussion. Then I started that. Then the things come out from them, that what they know. And they told me the story, they're part of the story about the door figurines, about the painting they make in the temples, the charcoal paintings. And when they do the ritual, especially in the morning, they think the shadow travel to the mountains. And then there are they depicted, you know, the pictographs are really connected to them to the nature. And they think this is the fertility for the animals. When we make the doe figurines, we are very careful to make it because the shamans tell us that we will make the doe figurines like you make the goats, you make the cows. And so the shadow of the cows and the goats, they travel to the Dizilavata, like the created mountains. So the people believe on that. And then they start talking to me about their experience, how they dream about it. And the special thing about my project was I meet a man, he was no more Kailash now, he become a Muslim now. So I meet him and he was crying while telling me the story. And he was so much emotional and he said that nobody comes to me to know about this story. And this is the first time I'm telling you that how I feel when I was making the Sharabirai. That is the doe figurine called Sharabirai. He was telling me that he was making the Sharabirayak and somebody non-Kailashi came and they start making the Sharabirayak with him. And then he dreamed about him. Somebody told him that your Sharabirayak is not allowed to travel to the mountains because you make it impure. Non-Muslim make, non-Kailashi make it for you. So he redo the ritual again. He went to the water mill, he bring the flour and he make another doe ritual for his animals. And then he share his shepherd when he was in the mountains, how he felt about the goats and about. So that thing, you know, that makes me really, you know, I was really feeling proud that I'm doing something which never done before. Mm-hmm. Nobody even think about to go to that man to listen to his part of story because everybody was thinking he's a Muslim. So there is no need to go to him to listen to the story from him. And the way he described the story and I felt that and he said that, you know, I am by heart still Kailash. And I want to do that ritual again, but culturally it is not allowed to do. But the way he loved the figurine things. So like when I do the all the research and all the questionnaire, I fill everything and then I come to know that ma'am, she is in Mohenjo-daro. And I was so excited to fly to Mohenjo-daro to see her and to tell her how great work I have done. So I fly to Mohenjo-daro, I meet her and I was just like talking continuously. I was not in stop and I was telling her that I was so much excited the thing I done because in the beginning I was thinking this is very difficult. I can't do it without the primary data, without any data I have in my hands. And there is nothing about it. Everybody is telling this is like, this is just the saying and like that stuff. So when I did it, there was a bunch of data and I was confused to conclude it. How could I conclude the data, you know? Mm-hmm. So I went there and I was showing her all the data and the data was like I picked things from here, from there and was like all the mess up. Like there was no continuity. Yeah. And Absolutely. She said that, girl, you made the chuti, like the bread, you know? Mm-hmm. And she said, there is no bread in your writing. Just try to do that. And then I was thinking, oh my God, how would I do that? Because I have a lot of data and from where I start and from where I conclude it. And it was so much difficult for me at the very beginning. Again, she sent me the paper and she said, okay, go to this way. Go through all to do this way. And when I done that, and there were three people in my life who are really my inspiration, who are really my mentors. And today, I think if I am in United States sitting here and talking about my people, the credit goes to them, Dr. Usma, Dr. Kenayar, and Dr. Samat. These three people contribute a lot in my life. Without them, I'm nothing. I can't do anything. So then the research was appreciated by all of them. Dr. Kenayar said, you did a great job. Dr. Usma, she was already my research supervisor. And then my director, she said, girl, nobody can do it like you. Because you're from the community and you're doing it for the community. So the thing was, it is not like the research was for the academic purpose. The research was for my people. You know, there are a lot of things they are due to the modernization, due to the technology, the people are forgetting that. During the research journey, I come to know that a lot of new generation, they don't know about the practices, the rituals they are doing. They unknowingly doing that. So like the thing was, I want to do this research so the future generation can understand What is the purpose? Was the ritual? Why the ancestors were doing it? So it was the contribution for my community. It was the the thing I really want to document for my people. So that is how I start that journey, and I work on the rock carving thing, because the rock carving is an entire world and people have a different belief system about that. But the Kailasha have a very unique story about it. And they think these are created by the supernatures. This is not the human creation. Yeah. So they believe that those carvings are related to their culture, related to their animal fertility, because the animals are really important in Kailash. So they believe on that. So that's how I work on it. And then I was heading the Chitral Museum. And at the very beginning, when I was in Chitral Museum, and I went through the data that how many visitors visiting the museum like per month. So there was zero progress. So then I start asking the people why nobody is visiting the museum. So I come to know that the people, they think that the museum is just the place where you can put the antiquities. So then I start promoting the museum through the FM radios, the social media, and with the collaboration of UNESCO. The very first time I do the musical concert in the museum. So during the 3 days, there were thousands of people. They came to the museum and they see the museum and they know about the Kailash effigies. They know about the Kailash culture, and especially the bones we collect from the grave site. And I was talking to them how much old the bones are and whom the bones are actually related, you know. So that is the thing. I'm so proud that I did that. And then through the museum, through the Directorate of Archaeology and Museums, we went to preserve the old houses in Kailash. There were three old houses that we pay the people and we buy the houses to preserve that as it is. Because the valleys are now the people coming from outside, they lease the lands and they make the new construction, which is really ugly. And there was a hotel in front of the maternity house and in front of the temple. It was three story. They put a lot of modern things, and they wrote in the walls that Green Pakistan. Green Pakistan means it's a green Pakistan. So if there is a green Pakistan, you are not allowed to touch the wall. And there was a Pakistani flag. So they try to manipulate the things that I'm not going to touch the wall. I gave them notices that do not build the hotel there because it is in danger. The community is in danger. The maternity house is unsafe due to the hotel. And the temple behind the hotel is really sacred place that was suffering. And the community was suffering. They came to me all the time with the applications, madam, please do something, please stop them, because we can't afford this, because it is our identity. And then I went there and I gave them the notices one time, two time, three time, but the man was not listening to me. He was thinking I'm just a Kailashi woman, I can't do anything. And finally, we destroy the hotel, we demolish it. And when we demolished the hotel, and then the man came to his sense, and he was saying, oh my God, she is something, and she did it. And she was not just talking, and she really did it. And then, of course, I was nothing to do that. My department supported me. The district administration supported me to do that. And after that, everyone who was doing their new construction in the valleys, they came to us to tell us that please guide us what kind of construction we are supposed to do. So now there are the people that are making the boilers there to do that. Yeah. Yes.
Can you just talk a little bit about the maternity houses? So it was the construction was between the maternity house and the temple, right? This is a very important place.
Yes. The maternity house is really important for the Kailash community, because during the periods, the monthly periods of the ladies, went there to the maternity house, they stay there for 7 days, 5 days. And during the childbirth, again, they go there. Because in Kailash, they believe that during this period, you are kind of it's a sacred, you have to separate it from the house to go to live separately from the entire family. So the maternity house is always considered a sacred place. No male is allowed to enter to the maternity house. If somebody has no periods, they are not allowed to go to the maternity house. Even you're not allowed to touch the walls. If you do that, you have to follow the certain rules. You have to go and you have to wash yourself. You have to wash your clothes. You clean yourself properly before enter to the village. If you don't follow the rules, it is believed that there are some destructions happen from the nature. Maybe there are flooding comes, maybe there are storm comes, maybe there are some destructions. The nature will take a revenge because you go through, like, you just try to, like, you know, the destroy the nature things, or you are try to not following the protocol of the culture. So that's how the people are, like, they try to protect the sacred places from the outsiders because they don't know what is the Bashali means, the maternity call in Kailashi, Bashali. So the Bashali is really a sacred place for the Kailash people. So they're always very curious about the graveyards and the Bashali and the temple. These three places in Kailash are really very important for the people. Just recently, I gone through with the social media and this festival, somebody went to the graveyard and took the bones and they were trying to make a video and TikTok with the bones, because before the Kailash people, they didn't bury their bodies inside the on the earth, you know. There was always the coffins in the open air. It is another story because they don't have in that time the equipment to do digging the, like, the thing, and then they make the coffins and they put it into the open air. And sometimes people advise to put their coffins in the open air to make some carvings on the coffins and to show them their wealth and their dignity in the community. So that coffins are open now because the tourists open all the coffins and they try to play with the bones. It is a very emotional thing to do that. But luckily, the people, they got arrested. And the graveyard is protected by, again, Directorate of Archaeology and Museums, Government of KP. And so now the people slowly, gradually understanding the protocol of the culture and the protocol of the valleys, that what to do, what not to do, yes.
I don't know how somebody thinks that's appropriate.
Yeah, it is very kind of, you know, that's why I usually tell people that the insensitivity of tourism affecting Kailash culture. So, but that's, again, as we discussed previously, like, people said that you're talking about all the things because, like, I'm chosen for that. I talk about the tourism, I talk about the climate change, and I talk about the archaeology, and I talk about the data collection, I talk about the culture preservation. So I'm very lucky to born in a family where my grandma was a shaman, and she was the predictor of the weather. She was the predictor of a lot of things. And my grandfather was a sun observer, which is called the Suri Jagak. Suri Jagak is inscribed already in the UNESCO's World Heritage tentative list, from where they are observing the sun and they are going to predict the entire year about that. What is the year going like? How, like, there is a flood or there is some, you know, a good year, bad year, a lot of snow, no snow, like that kind of thing they predict to observing the sun. Every year in December and June, they observe the sun and they make the points and to talk about it. And then they discuss with the other people that the sun was moving this much and like that. So our next article is going to be about that. Me and ma'am are working on that already, about the climate change and the indigenous knowledge. So I hope I try to like collect all the data from the valleys. So me and ma'am are trying to publish it soon so that maybe the people know about the indigenous knowledge about the climate change and like that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And what a special thing to connect with your grandparents through.
Yeah, it is. It is, like, I'm very lucky about like that. And they always make jewelry for me. And one of the jewelry they make for me, I gift it to ma'am because that was very special and very close to my heart. And I was thinking she's very close to my heart, so she can have one of them. So I gifted one to her. Yeah.
And maybe we can talk a little bit quickly about the beads, because the beads are all handmade, are they?
Yes.
Like, the beads are all handmade and your grandmother actually pulled it together. Right, yes. Now you're in a light blue and an orange one. I think mine is a deeper orange brown.
Deeper orange brown. And there is like some bones in there, like the handmade bones, like, kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. They're all handmade. It's all handmade by her grandmother. It's so special. And you can kind of feel, you know, all materials have a certain vibrancy, right? But when you hold the beads in the hand, like, whenever I wear it, I feel like I'm elevated. It's quite remarkable. It's just, so thank you. And thank you, grandmother.
My pleasure.
Well, I mean, I think, especially thinking back on when you were talking about your master's work, I mean, that was just a, there were so many points in there where me as the cultural anthropologist, I was like, yes, methodology, like, so on point. But
praise coming from a cultural anthropologist.
I know.
Archaeologist. Yes. Just want to put it out there. Archaeologist knew a thing or two about ethnography.
No, it was like, you can't go in straight with what you want to ask. That's not... It's not how people work. And have I been there on, I mean, not tea. I love tea, but you know, you got to eat what or drink what's put in front of you.
I think it's about respect, right? It's about respect. Yeah. And consent.
Absolutely.
It's about being extractive. Yeah. These are reciprocal social relations. And I think it's about really acknowledging that.
Yeah. So I wanted to, with all of that in mind, I wanted to leave some space for if the two of you had any advice or thoughts that you would want our listeners to come away from this podcast with.
So I think one of the things I would say, there are a couple of things, like if, you know, there's no one way to be an archaeologist, firstly. All the work that we do, if you are going to call yourself an archaeologist and you're going to train yourself as an archaeologist, however you end up doing that, archaeology is archaeology. Right? That's not for anybody else to tell you what it means to be an archaeologist. And I say that because usually, traditionally, folks have said that you have to dig to be an archaeologist. You don't have to dig to be an archaeologist, right? So I think there's something there. I think the other thing I would say is that remember that this is a marathon, not a sprint. So these are long journeys that we all take. Yeah. It's about knowledge generation. It's about knowledge sharing. And when you share knowledge, you know, it grows. When you hold and hoard knowledge, it doesn't grow.
Yeah.
So you really got to think about how you share and make, you know, and share that experience with many others. And that can kind of lead into community-based or public work or however you want to share it in the classroom, you know, whatever it might be. And then I think very similar to the first part, like, don't let anyone tell you that your research isn't valuable or valued, right? If you think this is important to do, an important topic to research, if it is, you know, if it is important to you, you are the researcher, you do the research, you know, like it's, I think we've spent far too long being told what is right research and what is wrong research. So, you know, just go get it, do it.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. Okay, so I was thinking about the, because like, since I belong to the Valley, so like, I feel a certain way about the scholars, especially about the people, not the real scholars. The real scholars are always good. They did a great job in the past as well. But some people, they believe they are scholars. So they're reading few lines on the internet and they jump to the conclusion what they're going to do. So that happens with me a lot. People text me on the social media and they said, hi, you have time, we want to talk and we are researching on Kailash. So, you know, so like if you're doing something as a Kailashi, I did a lot of research on my community, but I'm the most scary person when I'm doing my research in Kailash. I always to be very careful what I'm asking, as I mentioned earlier, what I'm asking, you know, it should not harm my community. It should not be dangerous for anyone. So if somebody's want to do a research or if somebody's doing want to do to good something for the community, engagement is very necessary. And to do the homework before doing something is very necessary. If you're going to do some of your research on a community, you have to do the homework first. So like what is the missing part of there? What the values of the people? What are they doing? What are they eating? What is, because they're different than you. You're doing a different, you're dealing with a different community. So you have to follow the protocols. Like a lot of people don't follow that. And that really feel me like I think people should do that. Because when I go to the Kailash, as I said, I drink almost 20 cups of tea every day to convince the people to talk to me. And then somebody is texting you on Instagram and Facebook. They're saying, hey, I'm going to research on Kailash. Can you talk to me? No. It is not me. It is the Kailash. The community is there. You have to go there. You have to experience the culture. You have to read about them. And you have to sit with them. You have to tea with them. Just like to be, never make them feel that you are, they are different from you. Always make them part of you. That's how I learned from my mentors. It is a very special occasion. Once I was in a conference and there were some people, they were dancing there. They wear the Kalashi dress and it was, the dance was not feel appropriate to me. And that time there was Dr. Kinnar and Dr. Samad was in that conference. And I took the mic and I suggested the man who bring the non-Kalashi girls to dance there. And I said, sir, this was really good. But if you do in this way, it shows the real Kalash, but the way you did it, it is not the real Kalash. And so I was so scared after telling that to the audience. And I was thinking, oh my God, my two mentors are sitting here. Maybe they will criticize me. What should I do now? And then the both came to me and they said, Dr. Kinnar told me, Gul Kalash, I was expecting this from you. And I'm so proud of you. You did it. And then I went to sit and I talked to them and I told them that this is the way to do it. And then again, he came to me, Dr. Kinnar and Dr. Samad both came to me and they said that, girl, you're doing really great. That's how you promote your culture. That's how you make the people understand your culture. If you just get angry on them and you not told them what is the meaning of this, then nobody understands it. You have to be part of them. You have to tell them like in your own way to make them understand this is the right way to do it. So you did a great job today. So like that is how like I think that I'm very lucky in this case. I have always the guidance I get from my mentors and my teachers, and they always support me, my ideas. If I sometimes I think my ideas are really dumb, but they always supported me. But sometimes, yes, sometimes I talk about something which is not even relevant to the things, but they always support me and they always think that I'm still learning and I'm still trying to be, you know, to good in my own way. So the support system is really good. If there is only one person who is supporting your ideas, if there is only one person who is telling you, Gul Kalash, you're doing good, I think that is a huge impact in your life. You encourage yourself every day to do more. You encourage yourself every day to make things right, like try to be right. If not right, close to the right. So that is how I felt that everybody wants in their life, there must be one Dr. Kinnar, one Dr. Samad, and one Dr. Usma to show them the right way how to do things. Like, yeah.
We can all use more mentors, that's for sure.
And like, of course, there should be one Jessica too, to listen to the stories of others, to telling to the world that this is the one part of another story from Kalash, from the very remote area just behind Afghanistan. There are some people, they are a special species in the world and most endangered. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was such a pleasure having you both and learning about an area that I'm not familiar with. And yeah, I really appreciate it. I also haven't like laughed that hard in a while. It was very needed. It was very appreciated. So.
Yeah, I think Dr. Usma, she's the one who always never allow me to give up on my field. And she always try to make ways like for me to come to the on board and to do the, like, to talk about my things. And thank you so much, ma'am. I really mean it. Thank you.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad we had the opportunity to do this. And I think laughter is always, it's important and it's part of being human. You know, it's a way to connect. And so I appreciate you opening up the space for us to speak and for us to be here together and just your questions and your generosity. It's been really wonderful, Jessica. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
No, really, the privilege is all mine. It's an excuse to get to like learn and talk to really interesting people doing really important work all across the world. And I mean, it's just a joy. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, Jessica at livingheritageanthropology.org. livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.